Amen. Awesome. Okay. We started talking yesterday. Oh, is everybody done with this? Do we have this down? I don't want to erase it too prematurely.
Okay. It's not going to erase anyway, so awesome.
You can still see it.
We were asking the question, why Jesus? And we gave the two answers. He is the revelation of the divine and the revelation of true humanity. Both. Therefore, he becomes a natural entry point. However, a lot of the times, the ways in which we talk about the way we live, the way that we follow Jesus, is we begin with our works. And honestly, another way of even envisioning this or looking at this is, we usually talk about the way in which we are followers of Christ by making a list. But a list will only get you so far. It's the lifestyle that we're after. There's a difference. And I'm not talking like, I've heard somebody even try to dissect the word lifestyle before in the sense of like, it's not a lifestyle, it's your actual life. And I'm like, well, the word lifestyle kind of means that. So it's not a list. It's your being. It's the way that you function. It's the way that you move. It's the way that you breathe, down to the very things like, what do you do with your money? Or ultimately, what is it that you're consuming or not consuming? All of that should be impacted, not by a list, but by a life or a lifestyle, which is dictated by Jesus' works. That's where we begin, and that's where we're going to begin today, but I want to fill out the rest of our little chart here. We begin by talking about Jesus' deeds and his words. I know I had an opposite yesterday, but it's not a big deal. Both of those mean the same thing, okay? It's just that you can't say his works and then stop it at that. You have to split it at least into these two, because he does say things that he does do things, and they are separate. These ultimately lead to what? What do they ultimately lead to? Jesus' identity. His works reveal who he is. Very similar to the way in which your works reveal who you are. You can know them by their fruit, he says. His identity, though, none of this really matters until we get to the middle portion, and that is Jesus' accomplishments, which we split into three sections: the cross, the resurrection, and the ascension. The cross, the resurrection, the ascension. This is what separates Jesus from everyone else that has said and done these things and claimed these identities. This is what separates him. This is what makes him different. Okay? This then defines our identity. Our identity. And from our identity then flows our works. I do want you to notice something, though. This is intentional, what I'm about to do. Notice this is a chiasm. What is a chiasm? Anybody know what that is? What's a chiasm? Yeah, go.
It mirrors itself.
Yeah, it's Hebrew parallelism. And so, matter of fact, a lot of times chiasms are developed like this: A, B, and then you'll have C. Sometimes you'll have like a C prime, not all the time. Then you have B prime and A prime. And what does that mean? Well, ultimately what that is the first point, the last point parallel each other. Second point and the second to the last point parallel each other. But what is the main purpose of a chiasm? What is the main point? Yeah, the point of the arrow. That's the main point right here. Okay? That is what they're emphasizing. That is what they're driving towards. So you see A and A prime. B and B prime. But notice what is the tip of the arrow. That's intentional. Because this is the main point. What the accomplishments of Jesus are is not only something that solidifies this, but it's something that actually empowers this. Because Jesus can say that he's God, and he can do cool deeds, and he can even say some other crazy things that reveal who he is claiming to be. But ultimately, if this doesn't happen, then it doesn't transform this much at all. And that's one of the reasons why one of the transitional lectures here will be the Holy Spirit. Because if Jesus doesn't accomplish this, the Holy Spirit doesn't come, and transformation then becomes quite difficult for us. The chiasm points to what's the main point. It's the accomplishments. It's one of the reasons why I always say, man, heresy for me is actually, I don't, when it comes to things we can disagree on, I'm pretty wide open, actually, except for really two areas. Jesus, what did he accomplish? and who he is. Once we, if we disagree, if you say, no, I'm sorry, he is not fully man, we have a problem. Why? Because his very identity affects what he accomplished. If you say, he's not fully God, we have a problem. Because his very identity affects his accomplishments. Or if you say things like, well, there'll be a 7-year period where the sacrifice of Jesus is suspended. We have a problem. Because that affects what he accomplishes. You see what I mean? Heresy for me is not women's roles. Sorry, I just think we can disagree on that. And that's okay. And we can still sit down at the Eucharist, at the Lord's Supper, and still share fellowship. A lot of the different issues I can disagree with people on. Some of them that will make other people even uncomfortable, like, even Genesis 1. We can disagree on whether or not it's 7 days. It's okay. But my goodness, you change the identity of Jesus or the accomplishments of Jesus, we're going to have a problem. Does it make sense? Why? Because that's the tip of the arrow. That's the tip of the arrow. Is this making sense? You following me? Jesus is the very center of all of this. But ultimately, what he does here is what defines all of this, or at least solidifies it and empowers it. Because if all of this is true, it's very easy then to sacrifice ourselves, because through the power of the resurrection, we know the hope that we have. Okay? Any questions about the diagram before we move on to start dissecting Jesus' deeds? Or thoughts and reflections that you're thinking, yeah, I don't know if I understand this, or I don't like this, or you're straight loony, other stuff. Yeah, that last one, a lot of people started moving. What are you thinking? Can't say nothing. Nothing? You're not thinking anything? Yes, yes. Good.
It's
good.
Makes sense. Because I start there.
Now, autobiographically then, tell me, what does make sense mean?
It helps me to understand the reasoning, I guess.
Okay.
Moving, like the difference between the accomplishments and the works, explaining that like there are people who have done the same things that he said and done, but these are his accomplishments, and that's the most important part.
Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah, Faith.
I think it's interesting. Like, it makes sense that there's Jesus' works and our works, and Jesus' identity and our identity, but Jesus is the only one with accomplishments. So, like, we accomplish things through him, but then that's still like, our works. And like Tasha was saying, like, there's a definite like separation between his works and the good things he did, and his accomplishments, it just completely changed everything. We don't have those accomplishments. That's just
Yeah, and I like your observation there. There's a collision here with us and him. There's a collision. And usually moments where there's collision is where there's an opportunity for transformation. And that's what's happening here. Because what's fascinating about this is that each of these accomplishments he then uses as a means of defining who we will be and how we will function. So he looks at me and he says, take up your cross and follow me. 1 Corinthians 15 says, we will be a part of the resurrection. And ultimately, the entire ascension is, when we'll talk about this later, is pointing to who we are. It defines his position as the king that is reigning at the right hand of God. But a king has to have what? A king has to have what? A kingdom. So what you do is right here in the accomplishments, what he had to initiate, the entry point, then begins a collision where transformation happens. And if the entry point never happened, transformation couldn't. But because the entry point has, then it is incumbent upon us to understand what that transformation should be and look like, which should affect this and this. And yet, this and this should parallel each other because of this collision. Matter of fact, and this is the way people even, though this word might freak people out, but if you understand what they're saying, it makes perfect sense. Greek Orthodox would call this transformation and this and sanctification, this discipleship, the Greek Orthodox Church calls it apotheosis or deification, becoming God. Not in the Mormon sense, but in the concept of we are becoming Him. It's not just something that you mirror and reflect only. It's actually something that transforms your very the very composition of who you are. It changes you. Not in the Buddhist sense where you become, where you separate off from body and soul, or the Hindu sense. It's not like that. But they would say, no, our goal is apotheosis, deification, becoming the hands and feet of Christ. I mean, even the language when we talk about our identity, it's frightening if you start thinking along those terms, where Paul says, you are the body of Christ. I'm the what? You are the very hands and feet of Jesus. You actually, when you move and breathe and walk, you're walking, you are Jesus to people. It's like, man, the introduction or the moment that I said thank you at this monastery, the Benedictine Sisters of Perpetual Adoration up in Clyde, Missouri. And man, they were just treating us so well from the moment we stepped up. Literally, the moment we pulled up, and we were like an hour and a half late, there was a sister that was standing there waiting for us. I was like, I am so sorry I made you wait. She goes, oh no, it's fine. I was just, praying and looking around and everything's been great. Like for an hour and a half, I'm so, I apologize. And then she had the beds all made and she's like, oh, and I stocked the refrigerator so you didn't have to go out and buy anything. We were like, you didn't need to do any of this. And finally, I just said, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And she just goes, well, you're Christ. I said, I'm sorry, what? She just said, the Benedictine rule is every person that we entertain is Jesus. And I sat there and thought, no, you're Christ. Because to have a heart like that is just different. You see the way this works? And honestly, what was happening there is both the image and God inside of both of us were flickering, saying, we should be something different and be able to view people different and function different. And in a sense, be experiencing some level of deification, becoming God, becoming Jesus to people. That makes sense. It changes the way you act. And this is why, again, I go back to and I hammer on this, and I have been for years now. If we knew who we were, oh, you just would do things different. If you only knew who you were. But we don't. And that's why so many people are so confused. There was a conversation I was in trying to help develop some of a CE program at a particular church. And the statement was made was that our goal is to get the people to desire to study the Bible more. And the moment that said, I was like, that is not true. It's like that is almost borderline bibliolatry. That's just not true. That's not our goal. Our goal is to get people to become Christ. That's our goal. And CE plays a piece in that. But if you think that our number one goal is just to get people to desire to sit in a classroom more, then you don't understand the whole concept of discipleship or education. You just don't get it. You see my pushback on that. I'm not just playing with words there. What we articulate ultimately will drive the truck that we're moving, the place that we're going in. How you articulate things is the vehicle. And ultimately, some vehicles can only go certain places. And whenever you're saying things like, the goal is to get more people to come to Sunday mornings, that's where you're going to take yourself then. That's not the goal at all. It's to transform, allow people to experience the collision. That's the goal. That's what you have to do. And you do that through a multitude of different ways. But the best way of doing it is by just exemplifying or reflecting or becoming that which you see in the Gospels. That's how we do it. Or the way Jesus would call it, make disciples. What is a disciple? A disciple. Why is it he calls us the sheep? Why is it that he calls us sons and daughters? Why is he doing that? All of those. In some sense, are a reflection of, an absolute blind following of, a becoming of that which is leading us. All of those. Sons and daughters, they mimic and mirror and do what you do. The other day, I was looking at, or last night, I was watching Robbie. Right now, because Robbie, we're not letting him, for the first 6 months or so, no one, Robbie's always with either Sarah and I. Just be, for bonding issues, attachment issues, and stuff like that. Although, my goodness, the kid just, he's just adjusted so well. But it doesn't matter, we're keeping to the rule. And so, on Wednesday nights, that becomes difficult. Whenever, as far as like being involved in like the different ministries and stuff like that, because Sarah has to be working. But the ministry I want to do, it's harder to do with a child because you're dealing with handicapped children and people and stuff like that. So it's like, okay, for the next couple of months, I'm just going to stay at home with Robbie. You guys do your stuff, and then Robbie and I will hang out. So last night we were hanging out, and he's just a fireball. He just loves to have fun, loves to move. And finally, he was screaming, and I went, no, no, no. I said, no, 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 we're not going to do that. And he looked at me and goes, and I was like, hey. I was like, are you taunting me? No, at the moment he was saying, you're my dad and I'm going to mimic you. And what I did is after I did that, I looked at him and I went, mah. And he started going, like, how can I do that? You could see it in his eyes. He was thinking, how do I do that? And that's what children do. That's how children function. And Jesus looks at it and he says, no, you call him Father. Why? Because you're his child. Therefore, whenever your father does this, and he touches and heals the leper, then he expects his children to be doing the same thing. Why? Because that's who we are. We're his children, and children should function like children do in relationship to their parents. You know, we should look like them. Not just with the color of our skin, not just with the different features of our face. That's like I tell people, my kids, they're like, oh, you know, our daddy looks like Jesus. I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. It's like, hold on. Long hair and a beard doesn't make you look like Jesus. And first of all, I keep telling them, like, Jesus is way better than your daddy. Now, I'm you know, like, follow me as I follow Christ, but whenever I fail, no, he won't. But my goodness, if the closest I ever look like Jesus is whenever I grow my hair out for a couple of years, I failed. That's just not what we're talking about. Because looking like your parent has much more to do than just facial features and body builds. It has a lot more to do with how you function, how you act, how you move, how you imitate what they're doing or not doing. Does that make sense? You follow me? This chart is doing more than merely just articulating the ministry of Jesus and there where we're headed. It's actually giving you a visual of what the reflection should look like. And also describes the power with which we're able to even do the transformation. Other thoughts? Is that making sense on some level? You know what this whole thing is called? I've not told you this the whole time. Maybe I have. But you know what all of this study has been called? Virtue ethics. What it is. Virtue ethics is becoming something. So if you ever want to study it on like an Aristotelian level, that's what we're doing. I just didn't tell you, because you don't need to tell you. What did Jesus do? Let's start writing them on the board. If you were locked inside of a, what is that called? An elevator, and you had a minute and a half to tell someone the life of Jesus. What would you tell them about? What are some of the things that you would say, oh yeah, I would definitely talk about this? What did Jesus do? Go.
Washed the disciples' feet.
He washed the disciples' feet. That is an interesting moment. One of the reasons why I find that quite interesting is because of the way in which John... Oh, I guess I should put the feet. Not Peter. One of the reasons why I find that section so interesting is because of the way in which John introduces the entire scene in John 13. And Huckabee and I preached on this a little while back, and it was this phrase that I could not get over it. John chapter 13, verse 1. It was just before the Passover festival. Jesus knew that the hour had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. The evening meal, wait a minute. Does anybody have an NIV 1984? What does it say? Stink in 2011.
Who?
I'm telling you. John chapter 13, verse 1. Huh. So read that first verse for me.
It was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love.
Oh, that is a way better translation. They jacked it up in 2011. Not surprised. Yeah. They said he loved them to the end. That is not the Greek phrase there. The Greek phrase there, he wanted to show them the full extent of his love. The full extent of the Son's love. The full extent of the Father's love. And what does he do? Because usually whenever we hear that phrase, what do we think? The full extent of God's love. What do we think? Cross. I'm not saying that doesn't, on some level, show the extent of God's love. But when he introduces this particular phrase or this particular scene with the full extent of his love, and then he washes their feet, this elevates this moment to a pretty high level. Especially verse 2. The evening meal was in progress, and the devil had already prompted Judas. Take verse 1 and verse 2 and put those together. What do you see? Why does John give us those details in that order? What do you see?
He's serving Satan. He's not like worshiping Satan, but he's serving his ultimate enemy.
He washes the feet, possibly of Satan. Now let me just piece this together. In Luke's gospel, Satan hadn't just prompted Judas. Satan had already entered him. That is stinking weird. He doesn't just say, love your enemies. Jesus actually does it. He does it in a way that frankly is frightening. Where you're sitting there going, you know what's going on, don't you, with Judas? Were you in the dark? Did you wash his feet and be like, oh man, I didn't know that he was already being prompted by Satan. I had no idea. No, Jesus says, I'm going to show him the fullest extent of my love, even in the face of my betrayer, even in the face of the accuser. I'm going to show them how we win. And he gets down like a slave and begins washing feet. Oh, and then guess who the other main character is in the scene? The only other disciple named, guess who it is? Peter. The one that will deny him in just a couple of chapters. Yeah, I would call that the full extent of his love. That, as Colossians 1 says, while we were still enemies, he died for us. That's a pretty huge moment. Pretty big moment. One of the reasons why, to this day, both Catholics and a lot of more high church traditions, they do feet washing services. Because they believe it's that important. And again, that's why I was blown away by the Pope whenever he didn't just wash the feet of a cardinal like they normally do. He went and washed the feet of a Muslim woman in prison. It's just different. It's just different. Is that making sense? Full extent of God's love can be seen in what he does. Other things that Jesus did. What's that? Forgives the woman caught in adultery. We're staying in John still. So John 7:53 through 8:11. Fascinating scene for a multitude of reasons. We're not going to get into the textual critical element of it because frankly, in this class, I don't care. Other classes I do, but not this one. This one, the whole point is this. That's a ridiculous type of love. I don't think it was a part of the Jesus tradition on accident. That's an incredible type of love. Are you actually in places where people are caught in their most egregious sins? And in those moments, how do you treat them? I think that's an important question that lesson asks us. A lot of times we stay so far away from sin, we're not at people's lowest moments. And whenever we do find out the lowest moments, a lot of times we treat them differently. When you're at people's the lowest moments of their sin, are you there and how do you treat them? What did Jesus do? What did he do? Yeah?
One of the things that I find most amazing is that I think he raised many to life. Like, I know that we see the story of Jairus and his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
But we also, in that story, he didn't raise just his daughter to life. You know, like, he raised that woman.
Mm-hmm.
Because he acknowledged her.
Mm-hmm.
And he chose to say that she was worth that time. Like, in that time where Jairus was probably rushing,
mm-hmm.
trying to get him there, he chose that, and the disciples didn't even understand that.
Absolutely. So,
to be able to tell people, like, I serve, like, someone who raised many to life.
Mm-hmm.
And not in just an actual, like, physical way, but, like, sociologically.
Absolutely. No, and that's a good distinction. As a matter of fact, first of all, let me just put resurrection. This is something that's pretty interesting, though, because you're right. The double entendre is important. If you go to Matthew chapters 8 and 9, right after the Sermon on the Mount, there is what I call a series of 12 miracles, although some scholars will challenge me because of one of the particular miracle accounts that I count. Is Matthew chapter 9, verses 9 through 12, through 9 through 13. What is that account? It's calling of Matthew. Why would Matthew, right before Matthew is called, you have Jesus forgiving and healing the paralyzed man. He restores two demon-possessed men. He calms the storm. He heals many. You have the faith of the centurion who heals the servant. All these are leading up. And then all of a sudden Matthew says, and then my calling. Why? What is Matthew autobiographically saying?
He was also called Levi, wasn't he?
Yes, yes, yes.
So he was a tax collector.
Yes, which means?
That he was being accepted even though he was the bane of Israel.
Which means sociologically, from the Jews' perspective and the Romans' perspective, he's dead. That's what it means. Jews hate him because he's in league with the enemy. Romans don't really care about him or like him because he's a Jew. He, honestly, the only friends that he has are sinners, the other outcasts. And what does Jesus do? He says, I'm going to give you a community, and you're going to be one of the ones that actually help shape the spiritual life of the rest of fulfilled Israel. Well, another way of referring to that story is a resurrection. He heals him sociologically. He gives him something no one else would give him. This guy was treated in the same way lepers were. And now all of a sudden Jesus comes and he's in the in crowd? Matthew says, honestly, it's nothing short of a miracle. Nothing short of a miracle. Which is why he lobs his story right in the middle of that, and right before the woman, the dead girl is healed, and the woman is healed, and the blind and the mute are healed. Matthew says, let me tell you one of the most amazing miracles I've ever seen Jesus do. It's whenever he came to me and he said, follow me. You're going to be a part of my inner group. It's a very simple thing to do, and yet whenever you realize what you're doing with some people, whenever you do that, you realize how transforming it can be for somebody's entire life. A glow begins that they never had before. They just, all of a sudden now, somebody looks at them and treats them as an equal and gives them dignity and says, you are so valuable, you're allowed to be as close to me as anyone. And they experience a resurrection. Does that mean every resurrection was non-physical? No, there were physical resurrections. I'm not denying that. But what I'm saying is, it is important on some level to say resurrection is a big category of which there are multiple manifestations of that type of healing. Multiple. And Matthew says, I was one of them, which is why it makes a major feature in his gospel. Major. We'll continue talking about the deeds of Jesus on Tuesday. Love you guys. Have a good weekend.